George from Tidal. We're here at Food for Less, as you can see, and we're having some alarming price increases.
Nobody knew that the Great Depression was coming. Unemployment, bread lines, bank failures. This was unimaginable.
When I'm driving my rig, driving this country,
the bubble had burst.
Things I see. There's a fork in the road ahead. I don't know which way I'm gonna turn.
That's Neil Young with his new single, Fork in the Road. We'll have more of that at the end of the show. This is Radio EcoShock. Hello, this is Radio EcoShock with something you can't live without, food. No, we haven't invented edible radio yet, but we'll introduce you to a homesteading woman who's brought out her second book on surviving the worst of times. Are you worried about the way the world is going? Our top financial institutions turned out to be hollow Ponzi schemes. Nobody is too sure of their job. The Earth's climate is unstable. Even the bees are dying. Meanwhile, grasping men at multinational food corporations want to own every seed and everything you eat. Did I mention the end of cheap oil? That is when I want to know how to ensure enough food for my family. How will I get enough to eat despite violent storms, perhaps an earthquake, social disruption, or even an epidemic? How can you eat cheaply, even if food prices soar, as predicted? Let's ask Robin Wheeler. She's the owner of an operation in Roberts Creek. That's a small community on the misnamed Sunshine Coast. It's by the ocean on the far west side of Canada. Robin runs ediblelandscapes.ca, and her new book is Food Security for the Faint of Heart. Recently, I ambushed this alternative grower at a Vancouver library to record her many ideas about how to survive in the city, even if the system breaks down. You'll get to hear that speech in a few minutes, but first I've got a question or two of Robin. Look, a couple of years ago, most city dwellers didn't worry about food security. Do you see signs this has changed?
Huge ones. There are many groups forming in Vancouver, Village Vancouver, and many small urban agriculture groups seem to be developing and reaching out to community and doing a lot of training really fast.
You tell us, I heard in the speech that some farmers are actually hiding livestock while people wanting to buy at the farm gate feel like sneaky criminals. What is going on there?
It seems that just as the economic system seems to be making a mess of our food supply, huge regulations are falling down from our federal government under the guise of health safety, saying that it's unclean for us to sell our farm animals to each other and to city dwellers. They have to go to an approved abattoir and be inspected before and after. And, of course, in a rural setting, that doesn't work. We can't drive a dozen chickens into the city or three sheep or two cows. As some systems are bigger, they might have 20 or 30 of these animals, but that makes it just even more improbable that these animals are ever going to see local food supply.
There must have been a lot of deaths to warrant these new slaughterhouse rules.
There have been none. We've been asking each other madly, where does this come from? It's been asked of in legislature. Where are these illnesses? There are no answers. We are not coming up with a single illness.
Then I would have to conclude that two big forces are battling it out for our food supply. On the one hand, we have the global multinational corporations. They want to profit from every human meal anywhere on the planet. They've lobbied and bought off big governments to pass insane limitations like we're talking about on self-reliance, on people feeding themselves. And at the same time, the system's breaking down. These big corporations, some go bankrupt, the international shipping's way down, there's a growing movement of people who want to control their own food and how it's produced. So how do you see these two forces clashing with each other? Who's on one side and who's on the other?
I've done everything I can not to turn into a paranoid person, but I'm battling madly against it as I see the proof is that at every move we make to try and increase local food supplies, more and more regulations fall upon us. I have to conclude that this is international in scope, affects many countries, is filtering down to every last small grower who's trying to sell their food to survive. So it does seem to be pitting small local growers against the big pharmaceutical. That's 35%, I think, of all the pharmaceuticals go into farm animals. The oil industry, obviously, transportation is huge in our food industry. And back up from there, farm chemicals are massive. GMO, huge forces at work trying to get control of the food supply. Seed patenting, it goes on and on. It's getting massive.
Well, how are you dealing with this on the local level? I've heard you've got a bit of a movement going to fight back. Could you describe that?
We have a few little campaigns, and obviously instead of miring ourselves in doom, we're trying to bring up some fun with it. We've started a Be Subversive campaign, trying to point out how crazy this is to be buying illegal chickens from each other. We've got buttons and downloadable posters for that and bumper stickers. This is about inspection as well. We've also got a sticker that says Black Market Brand, expect the uninspected, because the farmers markets are going to come under harder and harder weight from our local inspectors in terms of keeping eggs very, very cold, colder than is probably likely to happen. More and more food will have to be listed with them before it can be sold. We're trying to get on with that, trying to get some videos happening for YouTube so people can catch up in very brief ways with what's going on and have a much more knowledge and much more discussion going on.
And what was the name of the movement or organization, the Triple F or something?
That's the Farm Food Freedom Fighters, and we've got a small but very new website. That's the 4Fs, hoping for a few more donations so that we can do some better work. We're trying to get the buttons, and they have been downloaded all over BC, depending on the animal that the farm is trying to preserve. We must remember here, too, the farmers can't do anything about this. If they're hiding animals or acting as low and quietly as they can, this has to be consumers that come on board, wear the buttons, do the talking, connect with their government officials to put the pressure on.
Yeah, we need city folk to get on this. I mean, it's so pathetic to think of somebody out in the country trying to hide a couple of sheep in a back shed where nobody will see them. It sounds so medieval that the Lord will come around.
It's completely crazy, and it's not good for the farmer. We've lost many, many of our meat animals because the farmers can't afford to keep breeding stock that they've spent decades developing in the face of never being able to see a profit from the progeny and all the work that goes into it. So people are literally eating breeding stock, losing their income, closing down whole sections of farming all over British Columbia in quite a big scale that the city people aren't seeing.
And this is happening in many countries. I mean, I'm thinking of companies like Monsanto breeding their Terminator seeds so that people in India or all over the world are going to depend on this multinational for their seeds. We always used to store seeds at the end of every season, but not any longer. I think that there's a desire to regulate local food out of existence. In the United States, I'm seeing cases of it pop up, and even in Britain and Europe. So I don't think it's just a problem for Canada, is it?
No, here in France, they had a seed savers group that they've had for decades, as many countries have, was sued for competing with commercial seed sales. They appealed. They lost. They got a $50,000 fine for having their seed exchange.
Wow. Before we get to your talk, which I'm going to play for our listeners in just a minute, I wanted to ask you, too, there is some room still left for people who want to get back to the land, to a rural lifestyle here in North America, but certainly not enough for the hundreds of millions of people who are in the cities. They can't all leave at once. So what is your picture of how we could feed the city folk without totally overrunning the backcountry?
I think if I look at the normal yard in Vancouver, you can't feed a family, but you can certainly make a big dent in what you have to buy from these other huge monster businesses and monster farms all over the world. You could be growing a lot of your own fresh greens, tea herbs, culinary herbs, storage foods for the winter. When I looked at all the green spaces I drove through last week and saw rows and rows of front yards with just lawns, parks that could be rimmed with food plants, nut trees. There's a lot of gleaning that could go on, lateral growing up walls. we have a status system in place that says that this will make us, I think, look poorly, but I think that'll have to go out the window when we get hungry, and we'll have to get creative.
It could be beautiful to see food growing all over the city.
It could, and the main complaint was it might fall on the sidewalk and rot and smell all this nasty food, but I have a feeling if we were hungry, it would get picked up and eaten.
Yeah, we may have some hard times coming. We've been talking with Robin Wheeler, the author of Food Security for the Faint of Heart from New Society Publishers. Her website is ediblelandscapes.ca. We'll be hearing her talk in Vancouver from May 13th, 2009. It's full of solid information, so stay tuned for that. I'm Alex for Radio EcoShock. Thank you, Robin.
Thank you very much, Alex. Bye.
We've done a series of radio how-tos here at Radio EcoShock, ways to stockpile grains and beans for 10 years or more, how to get going in canning. Find that on the EcoShock features page right in our audio on demand menu at ecoshock.org. There's nothing to sell or buy there, just helpful free MP3 downloads. As you know, our guest is Robin Wheeler. She runs a homestead now turned into a home business in Roberts Creek along the Pacific coast of British Columbia. Find her on the net at ediblelandscapes.ca. That's ediblelandscapes.ca. Her new book is Food Security for the Faint of Heart, Keeping Your Larder Full in Lean Times. Robin was speaking at a small library here in Vancouver, listed in a community newspaper. Improbably outside, there was a New Orleans-style jazz band and rows of tables loaded with organic foods, community support kiosks, and alternative knowledge. On a rare, happy day of sunshine, would anyone turn up for a talk on food security? Waiting at the back, a 50-something woman began a conversation with me about climate change. "You know what I think," she said? "The climate has already shifted." I felt a slight chill, knowing that the public really does know we are in for a wild ride. Despite the sun and fun outside, all the seats filled up. I recorded Robin Wheeler's food security talk for you. This speech is like a series of topics you need to know. You could almost make a box of index cards for each resource in the speech as a jumping-off point for your own research on the net and locally. We've all heard about scrapbooking as a hobby for stay-at-home moms. Now I'm thinking a survival scrapbook or binder is really a good idea. It would have printouts of key useful information you discover. Maybe you can print out Google Maps of your area and your fallback retreat spot, with your notes added on where the wild mushrooms are, the We'll Trade for Food local farms, that stream with cleaner water. Imagine the power has gone out and the food system is breaking down. What do you need to know without access to the net? Or what if inflation and job loss combine to threaten your supermarket dependence? What can you do for food security from a condo, house, or a camper van, homesteading where you are? Here is a short shopping list of topics I heard in Robin Wheeler's upcoming speech. Most of it comes straight from her book, Food Security for the Faint of Heart. You'll also find this list for printout in my EcoShock blog entry for May 28th, 2009. Just click on blog at our website, ecoshock.org. Okay, so here goes. Robin touches on earthquakes, supermarkets closing down, power out, what freezer food to eat first, and how to prolong meat with cooking oil or salt brining, emergency cooking, stockpiling, the importance of community, organic or not, start a food co-op, cook for yourself, work at a grocery store or food warehouse, community-supported agriculture, gleaning like nut trees or fallen fruit, gardening as though your life depended on it, eating weeds, using food waste, storing the abundance. Leave root crops in the ground, she suggests, curing foods for longer storage, dehydrating food, canning, packing in sugar, teas for pleasure and medicine, flowers you can eat, gardens for renters, super fast-growing vegetables, she calls them Olympic vegetables, container gardens, wild foraging, food from the beach and the sea, emergency herbs, emergency water, power out lights and heat, working cooperatively, and finally, food activism, fighting off multinationals like Monsanto and Codex Alimentarius, and you can do it with local food subversion. Here is Robin Wheeler, recorded in the Britannia Library, May 13th, 2009.
The definition of food security, the shortest way of describing it, is that everyone has sufficient access to acceptable, affordable food. So that was the plan of the government when they went to many small communities and asked them to do their own analysis of their own communities of what that would mean to them. And then they handed out some grants so that we could fulfill them. So I was part of that group because I'd been working with farmers for years. I had started an organic growers group many years ago called the One Straw Society, and that gave me lots of access to farmers. And we talked a lot about food problems. Why aren't people growing food? What do we eat? What's imported? What are the problems that can arise? So when the government came to invite people to participate in finding plans in these slightly remote communities for food security issues, I was invited to be part of it. And of course, people said, gee, haven't you written for Momentum magazine? You had some articles about food and politics. You could put them together. It would be simple, and then you would have a book. And I guess they forgot the other 320 pages that were involved in writing a book. But this is where this came out of. They said, go ahead, take those articles and start us a book. And of course, I went home and realized that whatever I wrote was only coming from my own place. But for some people, food security is worrying if the supermarkets close down. We wonder where our food comes from, and actually it comes from a lot further away than the supermarket. The fires in Northern California 2 years ago, does anyone remember those? They closed down a lot of farms. They were burning through farms, and I woke up those mornings and said, realizing that's our food. It doesn't come from next door. It comes from California. This year, they had droughts in California, and they were closing down farms. That's more of our food that's being cut off. We should be very worried about all that. But it certainly got me going on what our actual issues were. Some of them is having that constant food supply nearby and accessible all year round. And some of it was stockpiling the food once we get our hands on it. And I wanted to start this book with lots about gardening, having food plants everywhere, having ballparks rimmed with food gardens and the parks full of food. And when I walked through Vancouver yesterday coming in, they have beautiful bamboo plants, and those are edible shoots. I don't think the homeless know all the edible stuff that's growing in Vancouver, because there's food that we pay to have in a can. So I had all this arranged that I was going to start with how to garden intensively and get the most out of that. And my editor came along and said, no, I want you to start this book with an earthquake. That's a likely thing that can happen, and you have to go there. And I want a scenario, and I wanted a bad earthquake. So immediately my plan was out the window, and I have to start with scary stuff. So that's why the book starts with scary stuff. It wasn't my idea, okay? But it was a very good point. If we have an earthquake, much will happen that we can't envision right now. Electrical lines could go down. That means we can't open those sliding doors to stores. The cash registers won't work. The refrigeration won't last long once the generator runs out of fuel. Our own homes, our freezers will start thawing out. Water lines might rupture and wash out roads, and we will be sunk. And as far as the earthquake people are concerned, it could take up to 3 weeks for any kind of normalcy to return. And that means 3 weeks of us being able to feed ourselves. So if you can imagine that vaguely, how much you want to eat, that's where you have to start. One thing I certainly went through myself was having my freezer go out twice on me in the past couple of years, and I didn't want to lose everything. Having to do triage, what has to be buried immediately because it can't live through even that short bit of being warm. What I could possibly salvage and stock up in oil or salt it, brine it to store it, and what I could probably eat right away for a few days, cook right away. So I realized a triage list would be excellent for a food security book. It is nice to have some things ahead of time if you ever had to confront this. And that would mean having a lot of, say, cooking oil. There's certain things you can put in oil. You could cook fish and put it in a jar and pour olive oil on it. Cheeses, of course, get packed in oil. Anything you can envision packed in oil, you can save things that way. Brining is a fabulous technique where you take a piece of meat and you can either roll it in salt or just make a brine out of salt water, anything that you can, I think they said bob an egg or a potato on. So I made up my first brining mix, tried to make it thick enough to float an egg or a potato, and found out, to my surprise, whoever wrote that hadn't tried it themselves, because eggs and potatoes have way different buoyancy rates. One of them sunk like a stone, the other was floating. I'm going, which one do I trust? Is it like having a thermostat that doesn't quite right, work quite right? But I just went with it. So the fellow at the butcher's shop had given me a couple of steaks. I had one. I had them both sitting out on the counter for a week. One just rolled in brine, and one sitting in the brine solution. And a week later, they didn't smell bad. They were really salty. I had to soak them a long time, and then I just dried them over the wood stove. But it is a way of saving if, for meat eaters. If you have a bunch of stuff in your freezer, it gets you a week or two leeway to save your meats. So that's a really good technique. If you're losing your foods, like your vegetables, those can be put in a very mild salt water solution, and they will keep for literally weeks in a crock or a big jar. So there's lots of good ways to save the food. So we talked a bit about saving food, and then my earthquake guy, Bill, brought up another problem. How are you going to cook the stuff? You have a lot of food, so what? How are you going to cook it? Which made me glad to have a wood stove, but I know you're not that lucky in town. Some people have barbecues out on their balcony. That's a good bet, and it sure makes you alert to keeping the tank full or having lots of briquettes. I guess in an emergency, you just start burning toilet roll tubes and... What's that?
Furniture.
Furniture, yeah. You can get a little saw out and off you go. Yeah, anything will do. And then when that runs out, I guess you get really used to eating things raw. And there's a lot of things that are good raw. There's whole raw food books, so it's not impossible. It just isn't as restful to eating. I know when I work outside in the rain up the coast, I like to come in and eat warm food. So when you're having an emergency, I think warm food is a lot more comforting than something cold. But if you haven't got a choice. So there's just some basic hints on that. Raw foods, techniques for cooking things very quickly, cutting things very tiny, having everything completely ready. So if you turn on a barbecue or you're using up the last of a fuel source, everything's completely prepared. Only to boil one cup of water at a time if you want a cup of tea, because it's a waste to fill a kettle full every time and use up all that precious fuel. And I talk about some recipes of things that are very quick to do, like stir fries, where you just throw the greens in, throw in some exotic condiments, and put the lid on it, and those are ready in just a few minutes. So there's lots of very quick ways to eat things. And as soon as I finished the chapter on earthquakes, I realized it was all completely dependent on stockpiling. If you don't have a lot of food put away, you're going to have nothing to eat anyway. So I went and approached a couple of friends who stockpile food frequently. One of them lived in the bush and traveled around on his horse with his bag of dehydrated moose meat. And he would drop in on friends, and they would make a fire and rehydrate the moose meat and throw in some vegetables and make stew. I know a lot of people don't have access to a moose, but there were some clues in there, and one of them was having a lot of food safely put away, more than you think you need, that people do get really bored after a while of eating this way. Having a stock of condiments was a really good idea. I've heard this over and over from people who have tried to live off the land. Black bean sauce can do a million things to greens that you can't do yourself. So that was a good tip. Then I talked to my friend Darcy, and she lived up an inlet, and she came out shopping once a year, and she had children. So if you can think of living and shopping once a year, you realize what a good shopper she was. She was an excellent planner. One of the things she learned was she didn't want to buy, for instance, a lot of cake mixes, as much as you think you don't want to give up your chocolate cake just because you live up an inlet. She found it was better to have the ingredients, the flours and everything, separate. Because when she ran out of everything else and had to live on just chocolate cake, she got really bored with it. If she'd had just flour and other ingredients, she could have made scones and all sorts of things. So she quickly gave up the instant foods and went back to the basics so she could assemble her own meals. She did keep everything in metal containers. We're finding two up there. Little mice will chew through plastic buckets and those rubber totes from Rubbermaid. So having a lot of metal containers around... She really did learn a lot about what she could glean from outside, leaves and branches, and we're going to get into that, all the interesting things you think of as twigs that might be quite edible. But she also learned to date and rotate everything, so she knew the oldest food was slowly going to work its way to the front of the cupboard. And of course, a clue in all this is space even to store things. Put aside a small apartment, where are you going to put that? And I think a community starts getting really important in an emergency, that you're not trying to work on your own. That if there is a shared house, that everyone gets together and has a shared place for food, cooperates with a barbecue, has all their different knowledges pooled, that's key. But the stockpiling is definitely a component that's helpful. Of course, then you run into the third problem, right? Before you could stockpile, you have to have a whole bunch of money. So I figured I better put in a chapter called Buying Organic on a Budget. And then my earthquake guy said, people don't want to buy organic on a budget when there's an earthquake. And he's right. You know, in an emergency, you're going to be scraping bugs off the sidewalk, and you're not going to worry if it's organic. So I realized I had to go back and start making a good list of how to get food cheap. And that took me right back to community again. We have an excellent co-op right on our street. A single mom who was quite broke started going to Vancouver and buying big bags of flour and rice. She would come back, repackage it in smaller sizes, but pass the saving on to her friends. And that got bigger and bigger. Someone would say, bring us some cheese. She'd get a big block of cheese, cut that up. Then she needed a fridge. She has built a whole thriving business out of breaking up large quantities of food. It's still cheaper than the stores, but getting into a buying group is definitely one way to go. And since you're getting into that, you might as well approach these big retails. Can you buy flat loads of stuff? What is the biggest size you can buy in and the biggest amount? And they might let you buy quite a lot once you have an account set up. And you can go back to your community and separate those flats, and then you have lots of food. But I sometimes just buy a whole flat of tins, canned tomatoes, for instance. That will get me through the year. I don't have to shop. And as I started learning how to stockpile, mostly because I live up a road that gets snowed in, I started realizing that even during the year when I wanted something, I didn't have to go shopping. I could park my car. If it wasn't in the yard, it was in a can somewhere, and I cut out a lot of worrying about what I'd forgotten off the menu. So that was another pleasure, is just to have a whole bunch of stuff sitting around the house in big quantities. There's more to that. Getting wholesale, going wholesale places and getting your quantities from them, that will save you some money as well. Making your own. We've all forgotten that in the old days people would just throw stuff together and make big batches, and then you would freeze some, and that saved a lot of money. Making your own soups and then canning them, very effective. All these stir fries, things like that. A good way to save money is just learn how to make it yourself. Some people up the coast, and I think there's a bit of it done here, go and work at some of the little grocers, and sometimes they can get paid in food, or there's a discount on the food. And that was one way that somebody found of approaching different people to save. They'd work for 8 hours, and then they'd go home with a box of food instead of money. Of course, up where I live, one of the ways to have access to affordable food is to marry a farmer. They seem to have food, but then I remembered it was modern times and you could just sleep with a farmer. But you still had to go up at 5 in the morning and pick beans and go up on the roof and all the work, so it didn't really save you much. Community-supported agriculture, has anyone heard of that? We have a couple of farms up there that are doing that. You pay them hundreds of dollars in spring. They use it to hire all their help, get their fences fixed, and buy the totes and get the fridge plugged in, and then they start feeding you through the rest of the summer. And it's a program that works really well for small farmers that have no capital of their own. And it's one of the women up on the coast is using 3 backyards. She's completely taken out everything she didn't want to see. She did ask the people who own the land. Planted it thickly. She's getting so much food out of there. She's actually made all her money back in the first year. She thought it would take 2 years after the investment of all the hoses and stuff, but she's paid it all off and she's really doing well. Have your own garden, of course. Gleaning. A lot of communities have nut trees, crab apple trees. You can get hundreds of pounds of nuts off a nut tree. They often lay on the ground and get scooped up and taken to the dump, I guess. We have some nut trees in some I guess, around our common areas in our community. I don't know what happens to all those nuts, but someone finally brought me a bag, and I opened them up and cured the nuts a little bit over some heat, and they've been excellent. They break open easily, and they're a real treat. So there's lots of ways to afford to put that food away, and it does often mean working with other humans, and that's not a bad thing.
Can I take your order, please?
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. You are listening to a speech by Robin Wheeler developed from her new book, Food Security for the Faint of Heart. It's from New Society Publishers and a real value for just $17 in paperback. She has an easy reading style peppered with humor, so let's get back to her talk.
I'm trying to start a new movement of edible landscaping where every inch of the yard is food plants, and that you cram it all and that it works all year round. And obviously there's a lot of skill involved in that. You're rotating crops through, you have to know when to harvest and store that food, but you can get pounds and pounds of food out of a small yard. We just spent the weekend doing edible landscape lessons around Vancouver, East Hastings, and other areas that I forget already. It's a bunch of houses, but we did some great stuff in very small places, and it was very interesting to map them out. So looking at even your very small spaces, you can do something constructive in there. It starts with what you eat. Of course, plant what you want to eat. No sense putting in a lot of cauliflower just because it looks good and not liking it. There's a lot of timing involved with growing food in your garden. Knowing what time seeds have to go in. If you miss a slot, you've missed it for the year in a lot of cases. But once you get into a routine and a cycle, and you just start going out and you start harvesting, and things become habit. But it is also another place where I'd love to see more people get cooperative, and the good gardeners are helping the nervous gardeners. I never say bad gardeners, just ones that aren't good yet, to get into the swing and start ripping up their berry bushes and giving them away. There's lists in here of all the foods available through the year, so people can kind of jump on the bandwagon anywhere on the slates. Someone asked me how this book would work with these timing maps on the other side of the Rockies, and I suggested if they just slanted it slightly so that all the months fell 1 month away to either side, they would probably be able to make that work. It saved me doing all that research of changing the zones. We talk about space, too. Maximizing space means using lateral space, taking out one crop like an early potato, replacing it immediately with garlic. There's all sorts of little tricks for getting lots more stuff in your garden. So there's a whole chapter on maximizing space, just in case people wanted a few more clues. And learning to eat what's already there, or eating your weeds. One of my favorite things is to walk around a garden and pick weeds and offer them to people, and they eat them, and then they get quite surprised. They could have been putting that in the salad instead of throwing it in the compost bin. There's lots of low-tech ways to stretch out your garden supplies as well. There's early versions of leeks and late versions, and there's early lettuces and lettuces that can do better with some heat. And some of the catalogs, like the West Coast Seeds Catalog, do an excellent job of describing all that, as well as having a really good chart in there. So you can keep an eye on that. Not wasting. I thought there was 11%, a quote of 11% waste, all the food wasted, that we don't eat or leave in the garden or strip away when we're preparing it for dinner. It turns out it's 23% of all food produced in North America actually is wasted. Either it goes bad in the store, goes bad in the farmer's field, goes bad in the fridge. And if we were a step ahead of the game and a little more used to making a soup quickly or a stir fry and using that up, we could certainly get some more mileage out of our planet, actually. And then we turn to storing the abundance. I had a person actually complain yesterday that he put in his edible landscape 10 or 15 years ago, and there's so much food he can't handle it. He was complaining about this. We did say he actually needed another human to come into his life and help him handle that. But certainly being on top of your storage techniques is going to be handy if you actually put in a good garden and have a bunch of stuff to look after. Some of the techniques mean leaving it exactly where it is. All the root crops can just sit there under the ground. Potatoes, parsnips, carrots, beets, Jerusalem artichokes. They can all just sit under the ground, mulch them in the winter, and then go out and dig them up when you want them. And they'll be so fresh right up until March, April, that you can't even duplicate that in your house. And that's my technique. And also you can be very lazy and do that too. Once you bring them in, there's certain ways to cure foods to make them keep longer. There's methods for storing squash so that it will stay for 6 months. And there's methods of telling a garlic to stop all that transpiring so that it'll keep a little bit better. Because all this stuff can go bad. Cabbage can keep for months. Apples could keep if they're the right kind. But you have to know how to cure them. I know they're not sick of anything, but you can cure them anyway. Potatoes can keep for months if you know what to do with them. So it's just all technique. You can dehydrate food. I think in the old days, they tried to bring this back of people having drying racks, and you could slice this stuff and put it on your drying racks, and it would keep in your kitchen for a long time. And we seem to have given that up. The food gets a little bit rubbery. But on the other hand, you can keep foods for months and years in that dehydrated state. And it's a technique worth learning. They sell those little tiny dehydrators, the round ones. You plug them into the wall, and then you can just put everything in a bag. I put my things in paper bags because if there's any moisture left and you put it in glass, it will all rot. That moisture has no way to escape. And in this humid climate, I just recommend the paper bags because they can breathe. But there's a lot that can be dehydrated. And sometimes if you don't put the dehydrator in the back room underneath the knapsack and the skis and stuff, keep it more available where you can use it from day to day, all of a sudden it starts being part of your life. Canning and pressure canning are super worth learning how to do. I make the excuse up there of I can throw anything in my rat-infested, water-filled crawl space and it'll never go bad, but people don't want to hear about it. But it's true. I can crawl in there in the dead of winter and shoo the crazy little creatures away and reach for a jar of soup or stew, and it's perfect. It's in there just as I preserved it. It will degrade slightly over time, but the thing is, it's a perfect way to keep food for a very long time. It needs heat source for a long time when you're doing it the first time, but then it's done. And if you just do it for a couple of weeks in the summer, you can put a lot of food away and then just relax right through the three-week snowing in thing that a lot of us had. I was very happy to have a lot of food hanging around. Packing in sugar, that's basically what jam is. All of our favorite things like sugar and salt and oil actually keep other life from happening, which we should remember when we consume it in large quantities. That all of those things are excellent storage condiments, so you might as well buy a lot of sugar and a lot of salt and a lot of oil because you're stocking up anyway. And then you'll have it if you ever needed to save all your fridge food for some reason. You've got all that stuff already in your cabinet. Vinegar is excellent too. Just pickle all the stuff and put it away. So there are certainly lots of techniques. I threw in the word freezing. We could always freeze our food, except if we have an earthquake or a real emergency, we won't have electricity. And then we'll have to go back to chapter on saving things out of the refrigerator and freezer. So I didn't go too far into freezing. We know how to do it. We do know how to roll everything in a little ball of tin foil and not mark it and put it in the freezer, right? People were surprised to see a chapter on teas in here. But I know in an emergency or when you're cold and things are going wrong, having a cup of tea can be super way of relaxing, something to offer company or people helping you. It's part of rituals in a lot of countries and for a lot of cultures. And there's so many things growing in our yard that can be thrown into a teapot that even if you didn't have any tea in the cabinet, once you recognize a lot of these as tea plants, you can just boil the water, make the tea, and at the same time accidentally get a lot of nutrients out of what you're doing. It's actually just a mini soup if you think about it. A lot of these plants, as soon as you soften that leaf, it's releasing stuff into the water. We don't even know how medicinal some of these things are. Peppermint tea is hugely medicinal. It could even be used in an emergency if you've eaten bad food to calm a very bad stomach. Lemon balm is multi-sedating and it is antispasmodic, so if you were eating bad food because your fridge went out on you, some of this stuff could actually help you feel better. So it's worth having a few little techniques for that under your belt. I did put in a chapter on please don't eat the daisies without a good dressing. We ignore our edible flowers. Maybe in a fix, we'd want to know what they were. Daylilies are a really good example. They're delicious, and they're actually nutritious. And every plant puts out quite a lot of lilies. It sounds funny to think of replacing a meal, but if you were hungry and even wanted to snack, you could get enough to cushion your stomach. Squash flowers, people have heard of those, with cheese, fried. Anyone tried that? Yes, they do it a lot in Mexico. Yeah, and they make a soup too. And a lot of our squash puts out, and I hate to say this, guys, but after the male has done his job, he's dinner. And once you learn the difference between your male and female squash flowers, you can go out there at the end of the day and just pick the males and bring them in and eat them. Fry them with flour and salt and pepper. And it's just one more bit of gleaning you can do out to put on the side of your dinner to fatten it up. But there's actually a lot of edible flowers, basically all of them. All of your herb flowers are edible, and you could actually really make a pretty salad. So there's lists and recipes in here for the flowers. One of the issues that comes up a lot is people saying, I can't garden, I rent, I have to move. That's a very good point. It's very unfair for people to put in gardens and then have to leave them. They don't want to put in the effort. But I think if we had a movement where everyone put in a garden everywhere they went, obviously, everywhere they moved to, after a year or two, would have a vegetable garden in it. It would slowly get going. So maybe we have to trust that we have to start a new movement. And I have written a whole piece in there, not a very nice one, called If I Was Queen of the World. I would make a law that people who were renting had to put in a garden for the next person, if not themselves, so they'll know what they're getting. That's a good point. Especially, yeah, don't pull that out. And then I realized, too, that we could be working again in community and having people who are renting using space in homeowners' yards to put in gardens so that it was in a stable place. They could come and go. The garden would be in one place. And there is an awful lot when I drive around here. Just imagine if this was vegetable gardens and all those nice front lawns. I think there's got to be a day for that coming up. But then I realized, too, that sometimes you have to garden really fast. So I made a list of Olympic vegetables. The only reason for me to use the word Olympic in this conversation. There are vegetables that are ready in as little as 3 weeks. And the Asian greens and the colored greens, the deeper the reds and purples are, the more nutritious they are. Those are things that if you were in a hurry and wanted quick food, that's what you want to plant. And you can plant them a lot of the year. So that helps, hopefully, having a little list of those. Container gardening. I actually did that myself when I was renting. I put everything in containers. Every time I moved, I just put everything in the car or truck that I had borrowed, move to the next place, take them all out, and start over. I was thrilled to move to a place where I could put them in the ground and watch them grow normally, but for the time being, I had a lot of food plants just living in pots and took them with me, and we all put in a change of address. So I tried to take away all the excuses for people not to garden if they're moving. Then I realized, living as I was in the forest, that for centuries before me, other people had lived in that forest, the First Nations people, and they had lived there quite happily without corner stores and without freezers. What the heck were they eating? And a lot of it was ocean protein, but a lot of it was also land-based plants that I wasn't using. So I got out the books on wild plants, and of course, they were eating everything around them. They were eating barks and extracting saps, and they were taking a lot of roots, which contained a storage compartment for the plant as well as ourselves for nutrients. So I actually went out there and started nibbling on things and testing a few things, and there's so many books on that. I only put in a chapter on it. It deserves books, but they're already out there. So I just tried to cover the basics, how to be safe, how to learn how to recognize plants, and then start experimenting, because you might find that you could walk out here and be eating some of the landscape if you had to. There's some edible seeds. There's lots of greens. Some are edible raw, some are edible cooked, and you want to cook them because they're too tough to eat raw. There's lots of berries, or almost all of them. And then there's a little bit in this on weird-looking bits. There's a lot of weird-looking bits out there that are quite edible. But again, most of them are mushroomy things that I don't want to go into this much space on when there's whole books on it. But there's a lot of fantastic mushrooms out there. And that bracket fungus, someone fried some up for me. It was just tasted like bacon. I didn't believe it, but it really did taste just like bacon. So I wanted to cover that for sure. And then I learned that basically everything on a whole beach is also edible. Every bit of seaweed, barnacles, seashells, everything was edible. Obviously, it's best to get some of it fresh because it's often dead by the time it washes up. But the seaweeds actually are as nutritious. When I phoned the man that wrote the book on the edible seaweeds, he says that nutrient for nutrient, they are as nutritious as anything you can grow in a vegetable garden. So if you were really hungry, you could go to the beach and realize you were standing on a foot deep of food. It's just the getting it home and making yourself eat it that's going to be the problem. But I've given some hints on how to eat some of it and some resources for getting more information on that. Because certainly with all of us being on a coastline, it would be horrible to miss out and have people starving when there was a bunch of food sitting right there. I put a chapter in on medicinal herbs, realizing that if something bad happened, like an earthquake, some of us might not be able to get to medical help. The hospitals would be jammed. Hospital workers would be trapped or at home. Roads might be impassable. What will we do? Our prescriptions are running out, or Johnny's been eating the fridge food like I told him not to. So I put in some things in here for upset stomach, bad nerves, infections, and how to make poultices. There's some very easy to find plants that are incredibly anti-inflammatory. Plantain is one of them, and it grows all over the place. And if you can break the cells open, break it with the back of a knife, mash it onto a wound, it's amazing how fast the inflammation will go down. We don't trust that stuff because we don't use it, but if you use it once, you start getting more committed to learning more. And I'll just wait for the doctors to get mad at me for that. I put a chapter on water in here. I hear in Vancouver a couple of years ago, after that bad windstorm, there was some turbid water and there was a boil water advisory. And I hear people were going quite anxious to get stockpile their water supply and were actually fighting in lineups to make sure they could get enough water at the same time that had been pouring rain for weeks. Which makes you really wonder how we'll ever get through an earthquake if that's how we handle a mild thing like a boil water advisory. Vancouver is in a lot of trouble. It's best to know all your water-saving techniques beforehand and have your supplies ready. A clean sheet of plastic, a clean tarp, some poles or sticks so you can make a great big V that will funnel into a clean bucket. And I say clean bucket because don't forget, if your water's cut off, you have nothing to rinse a bucket out with. So have a clean bucket, write H2O on it, put it away somewhere, and in an emergency, you have somewhere to store water if you do get your hands on it. We have to be a little more on top of it up the coast because the power goes out all the time, and we have wells, and we have electric pumps, and we have no running water. The minute someone hits a tree down on the highway, all our water is cut off. So we get a lot smarter about keeping one of those big plastic or glass bottles around with a pump on the top. And I do have water storage tanks all over my property now for my plants because I want to water them too in case it happens in the summer. But there's also suggestions in here for purifying water. Some people have been stuck with having to drain water out of their hot water tanks, water beds, or wondering if the pool of water out in the driveway is clean. So there's just some tips here in using bleach or iodine to clean any water you might have to. Then I realized, after amassing some information on food and water storage, that I was going to have to go back and talk about working cooperatively. That as communities, we are all loaded with assets we don't know we have until someone else wants them. Someone might have an empty basement when other people want to store canned goods, all the work they've put aside for the summer. Where are they going to put all this stuff? Someone might have skills. I tried to make a list here, knowledge on canning or how to fix that broken wheelbarrow so we can move some stuff around. Tools. Everyone's got a set of tools, and then someone in the middle doesn't have one. We should be sharing all that stuff. someone's got a front yard where you could be growing winter foods, and someone needs a garden, we got to share that. Motor vehicles. A lot of people don't have cars in the city, and that's a very good thing, but the people with cars should be finding them and helping them move materials around so they can stockpile and get safety stuff to their house. So I really loved, I'll be talking to the Village Vancouver people this weekend, Ross Moster, and he is very much encouraging pods of people in every community to find each other and form relationships with potlucks and stuff so that you can have all that support there when you need it. But I know that already exists in a lot of your communities. So I wanted to cover that. Then I realized, getting towards the end of the book, that in terms of food security on... I've been talking about a very personal level of food security. In terms of international food security, we're in a lot of trouble. We know that Monsanto owns the system. There's something called Codex Alimentarius. They are running how food is managed. I just spoke yesterday with an economy student who's from Siberia. She's looking at all these international issues, and she says that the GMO, the pressure for companies to conform to GMO systems is more and more powerful all the time. It will take huge work to fight that off, have our own food systems that aren't owned by anybody else, that we can rebreed. We need our own seeds. We need our own places to grow food. We don't need to go back and depend on them because they do own the works right now. And it is going to take a lot of work and a lot of communication to fight that off. On top of those issues, we have new regulations also coming down from Codex Alimentarius, and that is the meat regulations that tell all of us in Canada, except for two provinces, that, for instance, I'm up in the country, my neighbor, if he butchers a chicken, can't sell it to me. He has to ship that chicken to an approved abattoir, which might be hundreds of miles away. This doesn't mean a lot to Vancouver people because you can go to Safeway or Super Value. But to every rural person in British Columbia, to be cut off from all the local farm meat that we've been eating for decades is actually so destructive that farms are shutting down through BC. People are eating their breeding stock right now. There's no excuse to keep an animal alive if you have no hope in the future of being able to breed it out and support your farm on selling that meat. We are all sitting quite ignorantly down here about that, but I tell you, up there where we want to eat farm foods, this is devastating. Many more rules are coming down on top of that all the time, so fast the farmers can barely keep up with them. The raw milk thing, we must pasteurize milk. So if you have goats, you need a commercial kitchen, you need this refrigeration. The laws are tightening up. Our ability to make food casually in a community is being pulled away from us. So I really want more and more Vancouver people to know about this, because one day everyone's going to have to stand up and say, enough. What we're eating here is all factory farmed, California, Manitoba, whatever. But we have to make sure our farms survive in case we ever need them, and they are dying very quickly. Thankfully, we have someone in the room, Terry, who's been helping me with some campaigns. We have some people. I hope I brought my buttons with me. We made a campaign called the Be Subversive, Buy Local Food. It's got a chicken with a little robber mask, because that's how it feels up there. You go, want to buy a chicken, and there's a little chicken leg taped to your shirt, because that's how we're having to do it up there. Just to get the word out, to get people dialoguing about all this. We made some black market brand stickers for me, Expect the Uninspected. I'm hoping we can get those on some bags for farmers markets. We have to get dialogue down here, because up there the squawking is huge, and down here there's quite a void. So I'd like everyone to go away realizing what real shape we are in BC in terms of food security. It's serious, and there's lots of work to do.
That was Robin Wheeler, author of Food Security for the Faint of Heart, Keeping Your Larder Full in Lean Times, published by News Society. I caught up with that speech in a Vancouver library alcove. Her book is a great jumping-off point for dozens of ideas for surviving the toughest of times. I've listed some of her topics in my Radio EcoShock blog entry for May 28, 2009. Download Robin's speech free from our website, too, at ecoshock.org. you may want to start a scrapbook or index cards to research the food security ideas that will work best for you. As the economic crisis meets peak oil and climate disruption, we all need to get a lot more active in local food sources, learn how to work with nature's timetable, and store away for leaner times. As Robin shows, the coming times don't need to be all that scary. In fact, they can be empowering and even more righteous. Why are we treading towards obesity on factory foods laden with chemicals? Can we really keep colonizing land in South America and Africa from the world's poorest people to grow our soy and our hamburgers? How many carbon miles are in your cupboards? When we stabilize our society to our own place, sustainably for generations, a whole load of stress and lies will fall away. Food is a good place to start. The roots of civilization we could be proud of for a change. Speaking of change, next week we'll visit a unique unconference. It was called The Great Turning and hosted by Be the Change Earth Alliance. Hundreds of people turned out for an all-day gathering around circular tables. They talked to each other and plotted the big changes needed to save the Earth and ourselves. That and more next week on Radio EcoShock.
A major, major cuts and bankruptcies all across the board here in California. Nothing will make sense in the next 6 to 8 months. Everything will seem like bizarro world.
We'll close out with that Neil Young song, Fork in the Road Ahead. Go ahead and grab it off YouTube, he says. It's from a new album, but sample it yourself.
Out. Twist and shout.